You know, it's really after such wonderful presentations and you know, in front of people like Jean Paul and John, I feel quite humble actually. And I'm trying to share today is my own experience. And again, this is not on behalf of the organization I work for, but my own personal experience as a peace builder. And my experience with community peace builders, you know, this is a wall that in it from in the citadel of Babylon, where the hand that's said to in the book of Daniel, a divine hand is supposed to have you know, come and written a prophecy on a wall, and this is supposed to be, the legend has it, this is that wall. So, and that's where we get the phrase, the writing on the wall. So I wonder sometimes, you know, if conflict in some communities, you know, is it really inevitable? Is it the writing on the wall? Now, we tend to believe that peace is the natural state and conflict is the aberration. But what if it's the other way around? What if conflict is a natural state and peace is the anomaly? And all that we're experiencing now when we talk of peace are peace spells. Sometimes they're long. In fact, the era since World War II in Europe definitely has been called the peace spell. The long peace, actually. And we often wonder if, therefore, you know, peace is not necessarily, it's not a guaranteed finish line, but it's actually a much needed pit stop for us so that we recover as a society. I say this because of the way we imagine the levels of peace building, local, regional, national. We sometimes, you know, it's easy to think of it the way we look at governance, right? Local government, regional government. So like a Matryoshka, you know, doll. But what if it's actually more of an abacus where each of them has a place, it has a place value. Local, regional, and they don't always, you know, coincide. You can have peace at the national level, but not so at the grassroots. You could have a peace at the grassroots, but you could have, you know, MPs going at each other's throats in parliament. So you could, and this is, therefore, it's moving, but each of them has a place value, and you will never get the complete picture, especially when you look at peace as a process of multiplication of you know, benefits for the parties involved, then you definitely, each place value counts. And we often talk about peace and stability, but I believe that, again, the two of them don't always have to go together. And then justice is something that's, you know, very critical. And so we should probably be looking at peace, stability, and justice at all four levels. With that, I want to talk about Afghanistan and Iraq. These are I spent almost 6 years in these countries, and I have found that the two of them are very different, extremely heterogeneous. I've had a turbulent history over more or less for at least 40 years plus. And whereas in Afghanistan, perhaps the dividing line of in terms of identity is ethnicity. In Iraq, it is partly ethnicity, Arab Kurd, and partly sectarian. Now, what I found though was that no matter how everyone you speak to tells you a story of what they have gone through. And I will not bore you with the history of these countries, but when you go through these stories, you come to realize that every community in the country has been a victim at some point or another. And that, I think, is a very important thing to say whenever, as peace builders, we approach someone that, you know, and it's important to listen to them, as but to also say that actually, yes, the other side may be the perpetrator, but they have also been the victims. And perhaps victimhood, in fact, perhaps presents a very strong meeting ground. I wanted to share a first case and the lessons that I learned from it. But before that, what in Afghanistan and Iraq, the way we approached peace building was that we wanted to do community level peace building, was to ensure that we had liaison officers, or at least provincial officers in almost every province. At one point, the mission in Afghanistan, we had 23 officers, and then we went down to 8. But in all these cases, looking at, I'll just go back to this, looking at the diversity of the country and the fact that there are certain cultural regions in the country, Loya Kandahar, Loya Paktia, Kunduz, Jalalabad, this is how people in the country talk about that. Forget the provinces and the boundaries that are drawn up, which are frankly political acts. So based on these, we had regions, regional offices. In fact, ISAF also, as you know, had regional commands. And then inside these, we had officers in each province who were drawn from the local community, reporting in. Now, what we found was we hired local staff. They were, most of them were knowledgeable, former civil servants. They, worked with us at the international staff who were mostly sitting in regional offices. But the local staff were influential people, but they were, they were connected people, but not necessarily influential people. That was actually, and then they reported on the conflicts to us at the regional level. What I tried at some point was to get them involved as peace builders. This was in Afghanistan, and I found that it was very difficult. Most of them did not want to take the risk of becoming facilitators, because every facilitator faced a certain type of risk, whether it was physical or reputational. So one of the things I also tried was to get them to learn from each other, to talk to each other. And I found that at best it could work inside a region, but it could not work across regions. With this, I went to, with this context in mind, I found that I went to Iraq, and that was in 2015. That was right, not long after ISIS took over Mosul. And in fact, 40% of the country's territory was under ISIS at that time. And it was a very difficult situation, and at sectarian tensions were at an all-time high. And what again I found was first to look at the country as not by the by provinces, but to look at how people in the country described it. So you had a region of Basra, so you have Basrawi thinking, you had Najaf and Karbala, that's one way of thinking, but Kirkuk, another way of thinking. And then we had this liaison officers deployed in various provinces and who were from the local communities. You could have someone who would perhaps born and grew up in a neighboring province, but they had to be within that cultural block. They needed to, fall within that block. And in this case, we found that, in Afghanistan, one issue we found was that a lot of the conflict was Kabul-centric. It didn't mean that it only happened in Kabul, but it was done to get attention from Kabul. In fact, whenever people talk about local, national, peace building, I often wonder, I do not like this word, but there's a word game, which you keep hearing all the time. I used to hear it all the time. Oh, this is how the game, that's the game, and this is how the game, works. And it's very unfortunate because it's actually, the lives of people at stake. But there are so many political games that are going on. And therefore, what you see as an act of violence at a local level is just a signaling by one perhaps actor to another at a national level. What happens at a national level then translates into, you know, acts of violence at a local level as an act of, as an exercise of power. So much of our efforts at the community level did not bear fruit. In Iraq, again, context was very different. It was also because of the governance in Afghanistan was very Kabul-centric. The governors were appointed by the president and not elected. So everything was oriented. In Iraq, although again, there was an elite that worked in the capital, and there were efforts at reconciliation between them, a grand bargain of sorts. But we found that in the provinces, in the hinterland, far from the front lines with ISIS, there were a number of other conflicts. And this meant that instability could spread at any point. In fact, arms that were captured, in the struggle, in the front lines, sometimes made their way into the hinterland. And then that in turn, triggered new conflicts. So this was one case where we had these liaison officers. I tried something different here, and where we basically there were two provinces, and in which our liaison officers were deployed, and there was an oil field on the border. Now the oil field fell in the inside one province, but the employees there were from another. So when the workers were not paid at one point, the workers went to their provincial government, who then summoned the company. But then the one which hosted the oil field said, "Hey, wait, who are you to talk to this company? They're on our soil." They said, no, wait, this oil field, actually it runs all the way under our, So then it became a major, it was going to blow. And so it starts with something there, and then, it gets amplified in the media, and then people who want to, it's normal. People want to make, ambitious people are, join politics, and then it's part of, you never miss an opportunity in politics. And then it goes on, on the street. So these are just illustrative images. But what happens on the street is a symptom of larger political issue. So then what we did was we used the liaison officers in these two provinces to work as a team. And then they went to each other's provinces together. We did a series of things, as a result of which, basically, we had an outcome wherein the governor of one province visited the other, and then they mutually decided that they'll do a redrawing of the border, and that they'll go to the capital and let the federal government, which they shunned till then, take a decision on the exact boundary, but that there will be no room for violence, and they will talk to the company in question jointly. Fairly successful outcome, and all this done by people from the community, these peace builders, these liaison officers from the community. So what worked for us in this case? What was different from the experience in Afghanistan? Well, firstly, getting the context right, and I think defining the community by looking at the various layers of identity, so that it's not just sectarian, but it's also the provincial identity that can be very important. And, whenever we talk about conflict analysis, I think we need to look at the sources of tension and different ways in which, it is expressed. And I feel like sometimes, when you take a local peace builder, you need to look at how does she relate to what role does she play in your institution? What, how long is this person deployed? And to be very sure that renown does not translate into impact. The relationship that we as external, stakeholders have with a local peace builder is very critical to the success of the peace building effort. We in this case invested quite a bit in building skills of facilitation. But one of the most important things for me was that I was fortunate. I traveled to about 15 of the 19 provinces in the country to ensure that in each case our local peace builder, our local liaison officer, was introduced to the local government as, she's our lady, you know, he's our man. So if you'd like to pass on any, you know, message to us, please, you can do so through them. So that from being merely monitors, they got transformed. You know, they were empowered in the eyes of the local power structures. And then getting the crisis right. Now, again, we talk about peace building, but often it's just about swinging from one crisis to another to another. And I feel that if we get the crisis right, the crisis right over a period of time, then we'll actually be able to build peace. In understanding the cost of doing nothing, and as compared to the cost of action, the cost of action often, the biggest concern for external peace builders is reputational risk. What if I fail this time? Well, if you fail this time, that's fine. The most important thing is that what if you don't act at all? And then if you try to go in at a, you know, years down, and by the way, it may be another minor crisis, but you know, crises are like, you know, layers of a, conflicts are like layers of a mealy pastry, you know. So you have, they stack up over the years, and so it's whenever you try to cut through one, you realize that you're actually cutting through layers that have, you know, from decades ago, actually. So when we say we prepared a theory of change, but you prepare an intervention strategy, but identify all potential satisfactory outcomes, which means that a satisfactory outcome could be that there is no violence, but no one is exactly, you know, the winner. Perhaps one side is a decisive winner, and the other side, for now, you know, accepts a solution. So there could be any number of permutations on this. Identify all of them and be prepared for all of them. And then getting the intervention right. I think it was very important, consent, of course. And we all understand the very fact that we had deployed these officers, we had the consent. But then identify who can back or block your intervention. And then engage the spoilers very early on, potential spoilers. To be honest, what I found was that there were a number of actors who were spoilers because they were not getting attention, or they were not going to get attention. And you need to understand, why is somebody being a spoiler? Is it for the sake of attention? Is it because of for the sake of ambition? Is it because they are insecure about losing, you know, whatever they have within, you know, their camp? And then use your peace builders to, you know, use them in tandem, make them work in tandem, have them pass, meet either side separately, and then either side together, in pass back channel messages. You know, whenever there was a time when one of our peace liaison officers, in the course of a crisis resolution, brought his colleague in from the other province, a neighboring province, and said, "This is my cousin, by the way. You know, so he's just visiting. So we'd like to hear, by the way, what do you think of this crisis?" So it was a great opening, because it's normal, you know, to sometimes bring, you know, cousins to meetings, but it kind of helped, you know, for the cousin to for the work cousin to understand the narratives and the thinking here. In this case, we found, and it was important for us to identify champions, which meant that the deputy governor in one province and the provincial council's chairman in another province, we found them to be the most inclined to a peaceful settlement. We then empowered them as champions. We did not come out, you know, in the open and say that but we suggested potential interventions rather to the champions, and then let them do the trick. And the most important step, I believe, is to step back, because if you want it to be, you know, the solution to be locally owned, and then you need them to you need to step back. To just say that it's very important that the safety of local peace builder is the single biggest priority. And if this is compromised, you'll never go back. So and building the relationship is what's most important. Even if you don't secure a satisfactory outcome, the relationship you build in the process, always works in the long term. You need to appeal to different things from a sense of leadership to the cost to community, to a sense of reason, but also to emotion. And to never lose sight of why we need, peace. Whenever we say, what exactly peace means, and I feel, life is full of suffering. But there are different types of suffering. Maybe somebody didn't get a promotion. Maybe somebody didn't pass an exam. Maybe, someone you loved broke your heart. Someone in your family has illness. This is acceptable suffering. This is the only type of suffering that the human condition should have. If we aspire that you do not have to worry for the safety of your family, you do not have to worry whether you'll return home when you go out. You do not have to, worry that if you speak out, you will never be able to speak up again. Then that is not unacceptable. So our goal as peace builders, my humble opinion, is to limit suffering to what is not natural to the human condition. This is I'd like to leave you with this. This is a picture I took this was in Herat in Afghanistan. And what I found was remarkable about this, three generations from one family. And it was, my grandmother used to say that when we are born, our destinies are written on our foreheads. And somehow, the furrows on their brows, all three at very various different ages, it said something. The resignation of age, the anxiety of youth, the confusion of childhood, the fact that in all these cases, is something, I don't know about writing on the wall but I feel that as peace builders, if we can at least iron out these creases, then we have really been successful. Thank you.